couple of weeks ago, we were looking at the issue in verse 25 about the possibility of the change in attitude that the Gentiles were undergoing that Paul picked up on and was concerned about. He said in a previous paragraph that he was bothered by their boastful arrogance and by their high-mindedness and by their thinking of themselves as wise, because all of those three things boil down to the same thing, and that is a kind of self-congratulatory qualification for being in the favor of God. And that boils down to a legalistic mindset where we have done something that qualifies us for being an object of God's love. And that is militantly against grace as a concept. And it is in this chapter that Paul makes us understand just how opposed God is to that boastful, high-minded, conceited attitude, because he even warns his readers that if they persist in that attitude, God will treat them just like he treated Israel when they went into unbelief and persisted in it. But in verse 25, we saw that he still focused on the same problem that's finding its way into the theology and attitude of the Gentiles regarding his preaching of the grace of God to them. Because in verse 25, he's talking about being wise in their own estimation. That's a translation of being wise out of yourself, which is basically the idea that because I'm as smart as I am, I've got this figured out. And that bad theology and bad attitude are blatant contradictions to the truth about grace. The issue of the grace of God is a fine line, because on the one hand, you find Paul criticizing and condemning people who have received no grace from God. But on the other hand, he himself admitted that everything he was and did and said and all of that that was of any value was by the grace of God. That's kind of a hard balance to make, because even in the instruction to the churches under grace, there is this issue of human accountability. But if you take credit for the meeting the accountability things, well, then all of a sudden you're into this boastful attitude. So it's a fine line. The bad theology is basically the concept of talking about grace but meaning law, which is self-performance. It's the idea of I can meet this requirement that God has placed on me to a degree that is satisfying to him. And so that's the bad theology. And God's turn to the message of redemption in the Jewish Messiah to the Gentiles, telling the Gentiles that they can be saved by the Jewish Messiah, the Gentiles had turned that into a kind of support for the idea that there was some kind of moral superiority in the Gentiles that the Jews had either rejected or never had. Because the argument was, well, he was their Messiah, but they rejected him, we accepted him. And that feeds, if it's permitted to, it feeds an attitude of superiority. And that's the bad attitude, the inevitable arrogance that arises any time anyone has a sense of superiority about anything. That sense of superiority is related to law and pride. So Paul is dealing with some pretty heavy-duty stuff, but it's also very tricky because the deceitfulness of sin is real. And these underlying attitudes are driven by false theology, and Paul was picking up on it because he was noticing that the Gentiles were looking down their noses at the Jews. He even says in verse 28, from the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but from the standpoint of God's choice, they're beloved for the sake of the Father. So he admits that the Jews are the enemies of these Gentiles who have believed and the Jews who haven't. But he still doesn't allow them to develop this snooty attitude. So the latest form of this major problem was a firm confidence that the Gentiles possessed a superior and inherent wisdom that the Jews did not have. I recognized the good deal when I saw it. That's kind of the way it's expressed. I believed when I heard it. They didn't believe. They rejected it. So there's got to be a difference between me and them. And it's not just in the belief issue, it's in the attitude of why did I believe and they didn't. And of course, almost invariably, you're going to have somebody say, well, God gave us free will. And, of course, the people with the free will that chose Jesus are naturally superior to the people that have free will that didn't choose him. So. But Paul's response to that false confidence was a presentation of God's larger plan. And in verse 25, he says, God kept this a secret. It was a mystery. And Paul is telling them in verse 25 that I want to tell you about this mystery of the larger plan, just in case that's the reason why you're developing this superiority complex, that you're ignorant. It's not that you have a serious problem with pride against the Jews. It's the problem is you don't understand what God's doing, and as a consequence, they both feed into the same error, because if you don't know what God's doing and you think you do, then you're wise in your own, or out of your own self, and you're not wise at all because you don't know what God's doing. And the issue that he's doing in verse 25 is he's allowing a development of a partial hardening that has happened now in the first century to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So Paul's response to this false confidence is to explain the larger plan that God had kept hidden from the foundation of the world. He said it was a mystery. And it consisted of an allowance by God of a developing hardness, which is also translated blindness by some. They're kind of related ideas. If you're hard, you won't see. If you can't see, you develop hardness. The word is actually parao. It has to do with hardening. But sometimes it was translated blindness as a metaphor of the failing of your vision, some kind of hardness in that way. But anyway, the mystery was that God was allowing this development of hardness within Israel so that a certain portion, and admittedly a large portion, of Israel fell and became subject to rejection by God. They were the branches that he violently broke out of the tree. However, this permission of hardness in Israel was only to be temporary, which an enormous number of evangelicals today just don't buy that. They think Israel's time with God's over. Israel doesn't have a future. Israel as a nation is an anomaly, but it doesn't have anything to do with promises God made Abraham or any of that kind of stuff. The church is a spiritual form of the Israel of God, and therefore the promises that were made have to be understood in a spiritual sense. But the truth of the matter is, he says point blankly, that there is this hardness that's going to last until a certain point in time, and then the hardness will be lifted, or the blindness will be lifted, and Israel will be saved. So, the purpose for this allowance was the salvation of the Gentiles. He said that back up in verse, well, he said it in terms of God's plan of that he's mimicking in verse 14 when he says he's trying to move some of the Jews to jealousy, because that's God's plan. He is trying to cause the Jews to be jealous of the Gentiles who got salvation, it says in verse 11, to make them jealous so that and eventually they will turn. Out of their jealousy and envy, they will actually turn to God. And Paul adopted that in verse 14, says, I'm going to try that on my Jewish brethren. And knowing that the jealousy first creates rage and then later made me repent it. So he knew he was going to get it in the neck, even though maybe it would work down the road. But the point is, in verse 15, the rejection of the hardened ones resulted in reconciliation for the non-Jews, the world. And the issue of their acceptance will be life from the dead. So there is going to be a time when God is going to turn back to Israel and accept them. And when he does that, there'll be a resurrection from the dead. And he argues in verse 17, if some of the branches were broken off and you were grafted in, don't be arrogant, because it's not you who supports the root, but the root supports you, and so on. So the whole point here is that Paul has been arguing that God's larger plan involved a mystery that he hadn't told anybody about. We mentioned 2 weeks ago that there was some shadows of this truth in the Old Testament, but shadows have to have a thing to cause the shadow, and if you don't have a clear presentation of the cause, then you'll never see the shadow. But once you see the cause, then you can see the shadows in Old Testament Revelation. And that's the foundation for Paul appealing, for example, in verse 26 to the Old Testament, Isaiah 59, 20 and 21. The deliverer will come out of Zion and remove ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be the result of God's dealings with the Gentiles and making Israel jealous. So his persistent focus in this larger context is God's opposition to law and the resultant inevitable pride that comes from law. Law creates boastfulness. The only way to get rid of boastfulness is to get rid of the issue of law, because that's what he argued in Romans 3. As long as you think that you can accomplish it yourself, you can brag about it. So let's get rid of the accomplishment issue and talk about it in terms of somebody else accomplishing it and you just believing in him. So God's opposed to law and every form of pride that dismisses grace, and his opposition is absolute. He's actually going to condemn people forever because his opposition to this resistance to grace is absolute. He will reject any and everybody who embraces any sense of superiority over others because of something inherently of them in their theology and attitude. If that sense of superiority actually settles into theology and attitude, nobody totally escapes the pride of superiority because of the depth of its place in our fundamental human depravity. This issue of the pride of life is ground zero in terms of our depravity, and it's going to take transformation. That's why we wait for the hope of righteousness. It's going to take a total transformation that includes the redemption of the body before we're going to be delivered from that. So nobody totally escapes it, but there is a difference between occasional bouts of pride and enthroning it by some form of theology. There's a difference between that and a settled-in attitude. For example, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12:7, that very famous passage about getting a thorn in the flesh, that was from Satan, and he asked God three times to deliver him, and God refused. And so he said he would glory in his weakness because, he said, the thorn was sent by Satan to keep him from exalting himself beyond measure because of the enormous revelations that had been granted him. The very fact that Paul, after all this grace teaching, had to be restrained from exalting himself by difficulty that God says, I'm not going to deliver you from that. It's too dangerous for you to be delivered because you don't understand just how committed you are to this self-exaltation stuff. It's what God saved Saul of Tarsus from. But it didn't just automatically go away and never come back. Paul says multiple times that he had to be kept in restraint by difficulties. He even told the Corinthians that many of the troubles that he faced and being put to death daily was required because he needed to learn how to trust in God and not in himself. Well, he's been teaching everybody for years not to trust in themselves but to trust in God, but saying it and practicing it are not the same thing. And if the Apostle Paul had to be restrained by difficulties and had to be subject to a thorn in the flesh in order to keep this thing under control, then obviously it's a major problem. And that's why he raises it here in this chapter, because it is a major problem. So this evening we're going to continue our look into verses 25 through 32 and see how the doctrine of the larger plan of God relates to God's eventual plan for Israel and its outcome. And this, of course, is where we part company, solidly part company with Reformed theology and so-called covenant theology, where the issue is the words of God cannot be taken at face value. It's really a hermeneutical problem. Elliot Johnson at Dallas Seminary spent his whole ministry life at Dallas from time he came in the early 80s until now. He's retiring this year, but he spent all these years in the focus on hermeneutics, and that's how you interpret the scriptures. And he wrote a book on hermeneutics, and one of the evaluators of it from a covenant point of view said, well, yeah, if you accept this premise, then dispensationalism is automatic. But the premise was that words mean things, and you have to take them for what they say, and you can't just say, well, this really is more metaphor, it's more application to the spiritual realm, you can't trust it in the physical realm, and all that kind of stuff. But they don't seem to realize how much damage that does to people when they say, well, you know, you can't interpret that the way it says it. You have to interpret it spiritually. And then, of course, the question was, well, who's the spiritual interpreter to help me figure this out? It doesn't mean what it says. So it's a huge issue, and it's been a huge issue ever since Calvin and those guys came up with Reformed theology. But they didn't originate it. They just didn't shed their Roman Catholicism as much as they should have when they came out of it. Because Roman Catholicism had been arguing for centuries that the church replaced Israel. Israel didn't have a future with God, and that's why they didn't have any problem at all persecuting Jews. But that's what chapter 11 is about, that attitude. So let's just think about the nature of the eventual outcome as it says in verse 25 and 26 and 27. He says, there is this hidden reality that God didn't tell anybody about until now, that he was going to allow Israel to sink into a kind of hardness that would end up with him rejecting them for a season in order to turn to the Gentiles so that they could be saved. And then once his program for the Gentiles reached its apex, he would then turn back to the Jews, who by that time had been sufficiently exercised by their jealousy of the Gentiles for God's turn to them, that they would be willing to turn back to him. And that's what he says. There's this hardening that has happened to Israel in the first century. This happened. And it's going to stay in place until the fullness of the Gentiles has come. And then all Israel will be saved. Okay? So Israel does have a future. And it's a future that's going to blossom as soon as the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So his words of the nature of the eventual outcome are, all Israel shall be saved. Now, you have to understand that, those words. He doesn't mean that all of the physical seed of Jacob and Israel will ultimately be saved, because he already said in chapter 9 that there are physical descendants of Jacob that are not Israel. There is an Israel within Israel. And he rooted that argument in Romans 9 in the promise, in Isaac shall your seed be called. And it's not just Isaac, because Isaac was the father of Jacob, but it was the principle of a supernaturally produced offspring. It's the principle of the supernatural offspring that creates the Israel that he is going to ultimately save. We can call it whatever, but the doctrine of election, that's what it's all about. God has selected these people that he's going to produce as his own children by his own activity, in the sense of Jesus' statement to his disciples, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. And he didn't mean by that they didn't choose him. He just meant in terms of significance and effectiveness, your choice of me was because I chose you first. And your response to that was built off of the reality of my prior choice. So that's what's going on here. He had already said in chapter 9 that there was an Israel within Israel, and not all of the Israel that is the descendant of Jacob or Israel will be saved. He didn't ever say that. There are lots and lots of unsaved Jews all through history that are never going to be saved. They died before they ever believed in Jesus as their Messiah. And there's not going to be any undoing of that. But he's not writing about some ultimate out-of-time salvation. All Israel shall be saved doesn't mean, well, we're just going to wipe out time here and just put this principle up here, that God's going to save every person that Jacob ever sired. That's not it. His words are set in real temporal history. Israel experienced a time-bound, gradual descent into hardness, though not all Israel did, because Romans 11:1 says, Paul said, I'm a Jew. I'm not one of those that has been rejected by God. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin and all that. But It doesn't mean all Israel is going to go down in this tube of hardness, but the vast majority are. And in the first century, their rebellion against Jesus as their Christ and their crucifixion of him, and their persistent rebellion even after the resurrection, when the gospel went to them first, and they clearly rejected and persecuted the children of God, Saul of Tarsus being one of the primary perpetrators of that persecution, they persisted in it. It's like Jesus was on the planet for 37 years from the time he was born till the time they put him to death. And 37 years later, God put the nation to death under Rome. Destroyed the nation, destroyed their temple, destroyed their system. They couldn't offer sacrifices anymore, and they couldn't exist as a nation anymore. They're scattered through the nations of the world. So Jesus' death at Calvary and resurrection on the third day was the pivot point. And Israel's rejection was proven by the persistence after the fact. So that's what he's actually arguing, is that God has allowed this. And he said, granted, the Old Testament didn't say that all this was going to happen. It's a mystery. But nonetheless, he's revealed it now, and I'm telling you about it. That's what Paul is arguing. And it's real time-bound history. Israel was in a state theologically and attitudinally by the first century that they actually murdered their own creator. And their attitude was arrogance beyond imagining. Because even when he was dying on the cross for their sin, they were going by spitting on him and making jokes and, you know, mocking him and all that stuff. So that part was time bound. And then it says that this hardening has happened and it's going to last until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Well, that's another one of those time bound things. What's he mean, the fullness of the Gentiles will come in? Well, go back up to verse 12. He's asking in verse 11 if Israel stumbled so as to fall, and he said no. But their transgression did lead to salvation to the Gentiles in order to make them jealous. But he said if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure be riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fullness be? So there's going to be a time of fullness for the Jews. Well, what does fullness for the Jews mean? It means when they finally come around and all Israel is saved. Well, then what does fullness of the Gentiles mean? Well, it's got to mean that all the Gentiles that God intended to save have been saved now. That's been accomplished. The fullness has come. When that happens, God's going to turn back to Israel, and Israel's going to turn back to him. And then, Paul says, all Israel will be saved. So the first outcome is that all Israel is going to be saved, but this all Israel is a description of a nation that is set in a time frame, and it's a time frame at the end of the time when God is focused on the Gentiles. And once he's finished that, he's going to turn back to Israel. There's a pattern in the scriptures of this principle. For the first 2,000 years of human history, God was focused on the nations as nations. But their rebellion that caused the flood and their re-rebellion that caused the Tower of Babel caused God to say, out of here. And he dispersed them and basically, he turned his attention completely away from them, focused on Abram. And then he renamed him to Abraham, and he developed this nation that he promised him out of Jacob. And so, he rejected the hardened, the 2,000 years of Gentile hardening. He rejected the hardened, and he turned to the salvation of the Jews. Well, he developed this Jewish nation, granted many of them salvation in the process, but over time, he allowed them to disintegrate into the same kind of morass that the Gentile hardness had created in the Gentiles. And now Israel is just like the Gentiles at the time of the Tower of Babel. They're arrogant, they're boastful, they're unbelieving, they're wicked, they're hateful. And so he says, okay. And at Pentecost in AD 33, God turned back to the nations. And he basically turned away from Israel. Well, that's what he'd done to the nations. 2,000 years before, he turned from them to Abraham and the development of the nation. Now the nation's in hardness, so he's turned from them back to the nations. And when he gets through with his program for the nations, which includes the church, he's going to turn back to Israel. And he even says that in verse 32. God has shut up all in disobedience that it might show mercy to all. There were cycles of this in history where he showed mercy, but they rejected it, so he rejected them. Then he showed mercy, and they rejected it, so he rejected them. And then he showed mercy, and then the church is in its dying apostasy, even in our generation. And there's going to come a time when God says, enough's enough, and he's going to take the true church out, and then he's going to visit the world with the wrath that's coming because of the hardness of the Gentiles. And then he's in that period is going to bring all Israel to salvation. So that's the big plan. And that means that there is a future time coming when Israel will be plugged into this plan again as the focus of God's attention. And he will, in the process of his focus, purge all of the non-Israel Israelites. If not all Israel are of Israel, then those not of Israel are going to be purged out. Well, that's going to happen in real time. The Antichrist is going to be militantly opposed to Jews. It didn't matter to him whether they believed in Jesus or not. He's going to try to kill as many of them as he can. God's going to allow many to be put to death. Some who believe and many who don't. But that's his way of purging. So that Jesus' words to Nicodemus, you're not going to see it or enter it if you're not born again, if you don't believe that I am he. So out of this judgment that God's going to pour out on the nations is going to be a purging time for Israel. And at the end of that purging time, the only Jews left will be believers, and all Israel will be saved. That's what it said. All Israel will be saved. And then he quotes Isaiah 59. He quotes from verses 20 and 21 in Isaiah 59, and this is what he quotes. The deliverer will come from Zion, or out from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. Now, what he's quoting here is a prophecy. It's about a prophecy of the time when the deliverer will come from Zion. The problem is that the Hebrew says that the deliverer will come to Zion. And Paul interprets that to include not only coming to Zion, but then leaving Zion to bring about the next stuff. And there's a text in Zechariah 14 where the deliverer of Israel, who has come to Israel, is going to go out from Zion to destroy all of the adversaries. That's Zechariah 14:3. So Paul, knowing that the prophecies are that Jesus is going to return to Zion. His foot's actually going to touch on the Mount of Olives and split it into a great valley, and then there'll be this flood of water that flows out of it, and it's going to be a time when Messiah comes to Zion. But once that happens, Zion, Jerusalem has been surrounded by all the armies of the world. The Antichrist has marshaled them all together, and they're going to be turning their weapons against Jesus as he descends. But once he has touched the ground, he is going to clothe himself with righteousness and move out of Zion and destroy all of the wicked so that there won't be an unbeliever on the planet when he's done. That way, when his kingdom is set up, his words to Nicodemus will be literally fulfilled. You're not going to see it or enter it if you're not born again. So all unbelievers, all of the non-believing Jews who are they're from Israel's descendancy, but they're not of Israel because they're not a part of the promise. All of them will be gone, and all of the Gentiles who resisted the message of the gospel in their lifetime, but over a history of 2,000 years of preaching to the nations the gospel of Jesus Christ, all of those who have rejected and survived to this point are not going to survive any longer. It's going to kill them all. So Paul's salvation terminology, his basic thesis in verse 26 is Israel will be saved. All of Israel will be saved because that's what's written. Now, what wasn't written was what was going to happen in the meantime. There's a hardness, according to verse 25, that has happened to Israel, but there is coming a time when all Israel will be saved. And what was written was not about the hardness development. That was a mystery. That was not revealed. But what was revealed is that there'll come a time in history when all of Israel will be believing in Jesus as their Messiah. They will all be saved. And he says, this is the meaning of Isaiah 59. He even emphasizes it with these terms. He's going to remove ungodliness from Jacob. Well, in a very real sense, that's the bottom line of salvation. Having ungodliness removed. The prophecy of Jeremiah about the new covenant was that God would actually inscribe his law on their hearts and give them a new heart and inscribe his law on them so they would be his people and he would be their God. Paul says that that same principle is in play in the gospel of Jesus because it's the gospel of the new covenant. This is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for the many. So God is in the process of bringing many Gentiles into the family of God, the people of God. But the problem with the salvation that he is giving us at this point is that it's inconclusive. We're still in the flesh. We're still in the body. The body is not redeemed. We groan and travail and we wait and hope for the fulfillment of the promise of righteousness when it's actually thoroughly real. We can participate in the righteousness and the life by faith in the Spirit and dependence upon Him. But life's a complicated affair. None of us are really, really, really good at that. So the outcome is that we live with a mixed bag. Sometimes we live victoriously by faith, and other times we fail miserably by the flesh, and that's just the way it is. But there's coming a time when we see Him, we'll be like Him. Finally. So all the Gentiles will be saved at the rapture. I mean, everybody's going to be thoroughly saved at that point. And then he's going to go through this process of turning Israel into a nation of saved people so they can enter into the Messiah's kingdom. Unfortunately for them, if we can say it this way, they're going to go into the kingdom like we are now. In the fleshly body, unredeemed human physical makeup. And they're not going to be perfected in the righteousness that we are, having been transformed by the rapture or by death and resurrection. So, they're going to get, through Messiah's kingdom, what we have gotten now, with two positive things that we don't have now. Number one, Satan's going to be in the bottomless pit, and they're not going to have to deal with him. So you won't have to have James saying, resist the devil, he'll flee from you. He ain't going to be there. And then secondly, instead of corrupt human governments making all kinds of stupid and ungodly laws, we're going to have Jesus sitting on the throne of the world. And he is going to enforce righteousness throughout the entire world. Pure, unadulterated enforcement of righteousness. So, the Jews will still have their flesh to deal with, but they won't have the world and the devil to deal with. We have the world, the flesh, and the devil. They're just going to have the flesh. So it's not a bad thing. I mean, Israel isn't going to actually get its ultimate fulfillment in salvation in the fullest sense of that term until at the end of the millennium. But we're going to get it 1,000 years before they do. That's our hope. But the whole point there is that he is going to remove ungodliness from Jacob. And then it says, this is my covenant with them. This is what I promised them. And it will be when I take away their sins. So the bottom line is solving the problem of ungodliness, number one, by identifying what it really is, because there are two words that are major problems in the New Testament. One's unrighteousness and the other's ungodliness. Unrighteousness is treating others improperly, unjustly, being unrighteous to them. But ungodliness is treating God with a lack of legitimate response. So ungodliness is the worst issue. That's the first four commandments of the Ten Commandments. You know, respond to God like you belong, like you need to. And then the last six are having to do with righteousness. Treat people like you want to be treated. But the real problem is the attitude toward God. Because if the attitude toward God's right, the attitude toward your fellow man will fall into play. That's how John was able to say, if a man says he loves God and hates his brother, he's a liar. Ungodliness is the problem. He's going to remove that. But how's he going to do it? Well, starting with, he's going to take away their sins, just like he started it with us. When John came on the scene preaching before Jesus became active in ministry, his message was, if you'll repent, God will forgive your sins. That's the beginning. And he's still forgiving them. In fact, he won't even tolerate somebody making an accusation against any of us who are his righteous ones. But the fact is, we are not living with the fullness of the godliness and righteousness that is held out there as the final promise. Eventually, we'll get there.